previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
I believed he was innocent until I saw him on the news. You're going to confess to something that so horrible, you know, setting this woman on fire, you know, and you didn't do it? No way. No way. If it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, chances are it's a duck.
What makes a person confess to a crime he or she didn't commit? What makes a juror believe such confessions? And have we learned nothing from the West Memphis Three? All of this, plus a creepy karate teacher. It's episode 23 of La Plata Presents. Hello, everyone. We're back. And I'm joined in exhausting my appeal this week by first-time, long-time Annabeth Chow. Hello, PL. How are you?
Hello. I'm great. How are you?
I am great. I'm a lot better than the subject of our Most Wanted segment this week.
Oh, my God.
I mean, okay, so a little background. We are talking about Netflix's The Confession Tapes, which I got an email about like 3 days before it was going to drop, which was last Friday. And I was like, okay, called an audible. We switched up our programming for The Blotter this week. And Annabeth, you were like, oh yeah, I'll totally watch that. This is my worst nightmare. Basically, The Confession Tapes, AKA We Have Learned Nothing from Jesse Miss Kelly Jr., is about six cases that saw convictions thanks to false confessions and the aftermaths of those cases. They interview people usually on both sides of the aisle. They interview the convicted. They interview some jurors. I think it's a really well-made documentary series that is real depressing. Enjoy? Is not the correct word. I did enjoy it.
It sort of hit all the things that I love about a documentary. And my benchmark is the West Memphis 3 documentary. So if it makes me laugh for whatever reason, if it makes me cry, if it makes me infuriated, if it's well-paced, whatever. And this really is my worst nightmare. Because I know if something happened to me, if I were in the wrong place at the wrong time, I would get in there and just be like, yes, I did it. I did it. I got to get out of here. I need a cigarette. Like, seriously. So it is my worst nightmare.
I really, and this is like not one of the cases profiled, like almost all of them, they are still in jail.
There were no happy endings.
Years.
Yeah, that's what was really surprising, you know, because I figured they would give us a little relief, but there really wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, because I sort of assumed like, well, you know, if this winds up happening to you, surely it can be reversed. Because look at the West Memphis 3. But that took what?
18 years. Yeah.
So, yeah. And a lot of the problem, I mean, the first case is about these kids in Bellevue, Washington, I think, who allegedly killed the one kid's parents. It seems pretty clear that they didn't do it.
Right.
But because they actually live in Vancouver, BC, mm-hmm. the Mounties got involved and they had this special kind of sting operation. We'll get into it, but I think the reason that these then 18-year-old boys sort of drew the attention of investigators is because they were acting like 18-year-old boys.
Yeah, afterwards. They were being real stupid. Yeah, just kind of laughing and cutting up and, you know, not acting like, you know, the dude whose family was killed. He was just like, yeah, whatevs. And so, yeah, they were like, oh, he totally did it.
Yeah, I was just running around like a 12-year-old at his cousin's wedding, basically. and that did not endear him to law enforcement or the press, as we'll hear from Mr. Klonsky, wrongful conviction expert, in clip 2.
seeing that kind of thing, right away you think, oh, these guys, they must be murderers. They don't care about the killing. When in fact, it's an example of the way kids behave after terrible, shocking events. You could see there was stuff going on that was completely inappropriate. But if you're gonna be a serious killer, the first thing you're gonna do is stand by the grave and cry. When I see the way they were behaving, I think these guys, A, were a couple of goofballs, but B, they were in shock at what had happened. And there's no standard of behavior after something like that.
I mean, I think there is, but in Atif's case, the people who would have corrected him, his parents, had been killed. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. So this is where, like, this is where people start to run into trouble, is like a public perception of their inappropriate behavior leads to a public perception of their guilt. And then.
Right. Yeah. They weren't acting the way that we want them to act as a bereaved, you know, victim or whatever.
Well, and they're also acting kind of like bratty fools, which we all did when we were 18. And also perhaps within the last 48 hours.
Right.
My husband listens to this podcast and can't confirm. but it's like, how does it get? I mean, you see this over and over again with each case in the series, that law enforcement like seizes on a particular suspect or suspects as the solution to their problem of having an open case. And they will do literally anything to get them to confess, including on the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's part, this extremely Byzantine, like Rube Goldberg contraption of an undercover setup. We will let a National Post reporter explain it in clip 3.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police developed an undercover investigative technique called the Mr. Big technique that they deploy or they use normally in cold murder cases, but they have a suspect. They just don't have enough evidence to lay charge. What they'll do is the police officers disguise themselves as underworld figures. Eventually, the target becomes aware that he's dealing with what he thinks are criminals. They'll get to a point where they'll say, gee, we overheard somewhere that you're suspected of a murder. And they'll tell their target that he's got a meeting with Mr. Big. And Mr. Big is the head of the criminal organization. And the crime boss starts telling him things like, we know that you committed a murder, and now you've put our whole organization in jeopardy by associating with us. So just tell us what happened. Tell us what happened. These undercover sting operations take months to unfold, and they've got one mission, and that mission is to extract a confession.
What? Seriously, what? Like, okay.
First of all, Mr. Big, like, I don't understand why they had to call it that, but whatever. Secondly, it's a thread through all of them, right? They're like, okay, we're going to find the dumb one, or we're going to find someone who isn't that well educated or someone with a low IQ and use them to get what we want, basically. And that's what they did, because Atif, they surmised that he was much smarter and more savvy than his best friend Sebastian, so they went after Sebastian first.
But even that, I mean, I was not a particularly worldly 18-year-old, but it's just like, first of all, going around like 10 other blocks to get to the house next door. And then the whole, like, I guess the idea is that, and I believe Sebastian and Atif were like counting, like, I forget how they even met these guys, but they were like helping them launder money or something. So then they're like implicated in whatever this undercover or this criminal enterprise, quote unquote, is doing.
Right.
And then the sort of capo is like, I heard that, you know, I heard that you killed such and so, and they're relying on what another expert called criminal braggadocio for them to implicate themselves in the other thing, even though it's braggadocio, and they're just trying to impress a guy that they think is a real underworld figure who has actually killed people, even though, especially in this case, like, how, never mind why is this legal in Canada and then is, but is not legal as a tactic in the United States, even though it would be more believable in the United States because Mr. Big of Canada, like, no offense, Canada, but y'all live right and don't have a gazillion guns around, and I don't know.
Right. Well, maybe that was their workaround. They had to figure out a way to do it. But actually, what I was reading about this case after I watched it, they are taking steps to get rid of this process in Canada. So, because I think a case was overturned. And I think it's going, whatever the Canadian Supreme Court is, that it's going.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it boggles my mind. And then they have jurors talking about, I think it was this case where they interviewed that juror who was like, well, the prosecutor was a sharp dresser. Like, oh.
That's, yes.
Is that how we're deciding people's lives now?
Right. He was a very sharp dresser.
Yes. Like, and he wasn't really. Like, that suit looked a little dated in my opinion. But yeah, I don't understand how as a juror you see the confession and you learn how it was obtained. And even if the court lets it in, I don't understand how you look at that and you're not like, these are 18-year-olds who by definition are full to bursting of shit.
Yeah. Well, and it was crazy because every juror they interviewed on this whole series was like, well, I mean, maybe it didn't really seem like they did the crime, but that confession, I'm like, how can you not realize after all of this ridiculousness where you've seen the videotape of the confession?
Yeah. And you know, where Atif is literally like looking at, I mean, he's not looking at the camera, but he's sort of like looking off to his left, like, okay, whatever Sebastian said, we killed them. Sure.
Right. He's like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like he's about to start laughing, but he doesn't want this, whatever.
Well, and they both look very like they're drinking beer. They're just like, I think at one point, like Sebastian's rolling a joint and they're both kind of like, not smirky, but they're kind of bemused, you know, like they're just doing this, that braggadocio thing.
And they're also in this real tacky hotel room. Like, okay, like, do you go and drink beer at the fucking Garden Inn and talk about how you killed your parents when you didn't? I mean, the whole thing's extremely odd to me. And as a juror, but on the other hand, I don't want to be too hard on some of these jurors because I have a true crime podcast. I have seen the Paradise Lost films a gazillion times. I'm not like naive about the criminal justice system. And I've also been on a couple of juries, and often the priority is to just render a verdict one way or the other and get the fuck out of there because jury duty is a boring hassle that you're not compensated for. And I get it. We all saw OJ Made in America. It's not a perfect system.
Well, but, and also, you know, a lot of these cases happened a long time ago before we had a ton of true crime shows and before all the, you know, documentaries and all the Innocence Project stuff came out. So, you know, they weren't as well informed.
Well, and particularly in this case, it seems that Atif's father had discovered via engineering means that where they were in Vancouver or Bellevue, he had figured out that where most mosques in the city were pointing at as true east was actually a degree and a half off on the compass. Yes.
That was crazy to me.
There is a, you know, believable, like reasonable doubt argument to be made that this splinter group was like fundamentalistically enraged by this information and murdered him and his wife and disabled daughter for it because they were home. But because it was the mid 90s, no one was necessarily focusing on that. Whereas minutes after September 11th, 2001, they would have been all over it like flies on shit. Let's hear clip four.
That kind of violence related to this community in that area was probably just very alien to Detective Thompson, and it didn't resonate with him, and he probably didn't really know how to follow up on it.
In the post 9/11 world, would they have pursued this line of investigative inquiry? Almost certainly they would have pursued it with more vigor. But this took place years before 9/11, and they didn't go there.
Well, and one gets the sense based on this investigative team that they would have seized on something else that was probably wrong and ridden that into the ground too. Like, this is not covering, like, this is not covering police in any community with glory, certainly.
Oh, no. Yeah. I remember, like, one of the parts, I guess it was the detective on the case, and he said something like, well, they were reading a lot of Nietzsche. So, you know, obviously that's why they were murderers. And I was like, what? Is this
that's still a thing?
Yeah, satanic panic. Okay, I get that. But Nietzsche? Like, I don't know.
they had to read that in school. We all did, or some of us did. I don't know. And I think jurors often accept, and this is a theme that comes up both with people who made these false confessions and with jurors who are like, well, it's the cops.
Yeah.
We trust those people. We trust law enforcement. They're law enforcement.
Right. They're doing the right thing.
Which is, yeah, I think if you gave these people, if all of this were happening sort of in the present day, I think people would be much more.
Right. Yeah. Can you imagine this case on Twitter? You know?
Oh, Jesus. Seriously. Well, and, but it's still powerful because as we heard in the opening clip, and as we'll hear in clip five, people like there's only just now starting to be a fuller understanding in the culture of how and why people would say they did something they didn't do, even if it's something really horrible.
Even if the content of the confession is demonstrated to be false, juries think, I would never do that. I would never make incriminating statements, false statements about myself. Only a guilty person would do that. That's part of the negative power of confessions evidence.
Yeah. So that is from the first two episodes covered the single case, which is called True East, and that's Sebastian and Atif. Then I believe the third one is a guy who is alleged to have set his girlfriend and the entire bar that she was in on fire.
Yes. Wes Myers, I think.
Right. Yeah. And then there's one about a woman who allegedly set her teenage daughter, who she used to be very close to until the teenage daughter started acting a major fool. Set her on fire using a gas can that had gone missing, but then turned up again. Like, what kind of bonehead leaves that? Well, whatever.
Yeah.
And there's the guy who accidentally drove his whole family into the Detroit River.
Yeah, that one was crazy.
That's the last one. I found all of these pretty compelling. And in particular, the cases with fire. I don't know if you ever watched this Frontline, which was about the Cameron Todd Willingham case.
Yeah.
And how he's been executed now, but it's pretty clear that he
did not do it.
Didn't.
Right.
Did not do it. And that arson investigation science is continually getting it wrong for like decades now. Were there any cases that you thought were boring or that you would recommend people skip if they don't have time to watch the whole series?
Honestly, the fire ones were the least interesting to me. I don't know why. It seemed like the pacing of those was a little bit different. It just seemed a little like more ponderous. Kind of, and I was like, okay, I've seen enough landscape, like get to the point. you know? I mean, they were interesting, but my favorites were definitely the first and second one, and then the last one.
Well, you called for our last clip from this section, which is about this poor man who claims that something went horribly wrong with his station wagon's accelerator.
Yeah.
Which is how he wound up accelerating down a dead end street, bursting through a fence and burying the station wagon in the river. And only he and his wife got out.
Yeah.
And I will also add here that there is some stern crime scene footage in all of these. It's not like quite to the level of Nicole Brown Simpson in the Made in America documentary, but it's bad. And watching these babies being taken out of the water in episode 7 is not like, I can never watch that 54 minutes of programming ever again, because it's just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
I can't.
It's really, really bad. Yeah, but I think.
So you asked for this last clip. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you wanted to hear this portion of the last episode?
Yeah. Okay, so this dude is accused of killing his 4 children by driving a station wagon into the river. And he says that he had a leg cramp, his foot got stuck, the accelerator got stuck, a bunch of different excuses, but they all kind of made a little bit of sense. And this really just illustrates to me the lengths that people will go to get a confession out of somebody. Because when you listen to this clip, this man, he is so broken, and the interviewer is so soothing and almost hypnotic in the way that he talks about these dead children. Anyway, yeah, play the clip and then we can talk about the rest of it.
And yeah, let's also talk about this guy is, I believe, the lie detector administrator of the polygraph tech. And there's a whole section about how he's like practiced with like martial arts with Buddhist monks.
Right.
So he's very Zen and knows how to beat the tech. Okay. Well, anyway, we'll get into that. Here's the clip.
I don't know if it was the baby crying so loud, and I don't know why the Lord empowered children with the ability to cry at the pitch and frequency that they are able to. But you know, I threatened my own daughter to tie her in a garbage bag and leave her in a closet for a while. You know, when she was small. Just damn kid, shut up. And I'd have to leave.
Kids are making a lot of noise, they just turn the radio up. You know? Alright, you're saying I flipped.
I am saying that something happened with you.
Oh my God. It's so bad. It makes me break out into hives listening to him say, like, yeah, sometimes I want to put my daughter in a garbage bag and throw her in the closet. You probably just went crazy. And he's like, are you saying I flipped? And then he immediately confesses to the crime. He's like, I guess I did it.
Yeah, I mean, they had 4 kids. Like, it's the 4th one screaming that finally sends you around the bend. I mean, look.
And he even says
certain
that.
Babies.
He's like, this is our 4th baby. Like, I've went through 3 other ones teething. And we turned the radio up. You know?
Exactly.
So this guy, Larry Delisle, he reminded me of like the love child of Ted Bundy and Ryan Adams. So like one of
kind of.
So like
I
one of them is terrible and one of them is awesome. So I had very conflicting feelings watching him, just as an aside.
Well, and that was one of the more chilling, like you always hope that it's like, oh, they have some more appeals left. No, like almost all of them I think Wes is out on house arrest waiting to be retried because what the fuck? And then one of his prison pen pals, or no, he knew her from before. And then she would go and visit him and they would play gin rummy and she saved all the scorecards, which is cute. And now they're married.
And now they're married. Cute. Yeah. And they actually, so he did what the West Memphis 3 did. Basically, he took a plea that where he pled guilty to manslaughter. And so they're not going to retry him, which is good news.
Oh, okay, so, good.
Yeah.
Because he was just, like, in his trailer, like, cooking and...
Oh, my God, when he was just cooking those catfish.
I know. Just looking devastated. Right. But the last Chiron of the last episode, I think, was that his wife stood by him for a while, but they got divorced in... This happened in 84, I think. They got divorced in 95, and then the Chiron said that her family and friends have lost track of her. Like,
what?
How do you lose track of someone in this day and age? I managed to restrain myself from rushing onto Reddit to see if someone had found her, because I didn't want to be that person, but I considered it.
Yeah, that is weird. It makes you think, like... They stuck by him, but not her. And why? You know?
Yeah.
So,
Or also why, you know, what led to them getting divorced, like, after that period of time? It just seems like, I mean, I can see him being like, just go live your life. Right. But the only other person who has even an inkling of what you're going through.
Right.
You're going to get divorced.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, yeah, not a pick-me-up, but it's a pretty well-done series. I wish Netflix had put more like marketing oomph behind it, but I am seeing people talk about it on Twitter, and I think it's a good series. Just, you know, keep a pet or trusted friend or spouse nearby to give you a hug because, wow. And also, lawyer. Always, always ask for a lawyer. I don't care if you didn't do anything. Ask for a lawyer.
Do not be in that room alone without somebody. Yeah, I thought it was great. There were some funny moments, you know. There's always just funny moments, especially with people with Southern accents are always funny. Like in the last one, Larry's friend, I think his name is JoJo, but he was like, you know, Larry's dad suicided. And I was like, oh, God. This is the greatest.
Oh, that's right. Oh, no. Wasn't JoJo friends with...
Oh, it was Lavelle. Lavelle. Sorry. Whoever Larry's friend was when he was like, Larry's dad suicided, I fell out.
Oh, yeah. JoJo is quite an interesting character, too. Like, I think this human being is like 6 foot six, 3.5 bills. And you could tell because the camera is like back a little bit just to fit all of him in. The frame.
Right. And he's in front of like a tow truck and he fills the whole tow truck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, JoJo.
All right. Well, that's the confession tapes. It's on Netflix. The whole series is out. And we look forward to hearing your thoughts about it on our forums at previously.tv/forums. Well, not everyone needs a lawyer, although this case took some twists and turns before the final act, which did not require a lawyer on the part of the perpetrator. This is our cold case section. Annabeth has brought us an episode of Unraveled, which I had never watched before. Season 2, Episode 2, Day of Reckoning. This concerns... God, what is Gary Plachet. Yeah. Who in 1984 was separated from his wife. He wasn't seeing that much of the kids. His then 11-year-old son, Jody, was taking karate lessons from Jeffrey Doucette. Jeffrey Doucette, it turned out, had been sexually abusing Jody for at least a year before. In February of 1984, Doucette kidnapped Jody and took him to a motel in California where he continued to sexually assault him. Police searched the country for Jody and he was eventually found after Doucette fucked up and allowed Jody to place a collect call to his mother from the motel room. The cops raided the motel. Doucette was arrested without incident. He was extradited back to Louisiana. Doucette was being escorted through the airport when he walked past Plachet, who took out his gun and fired a single shot directly at the right side of Doucette's head. At point-blank range, Doucette immediately fell to the floor. Plachet was taken into custody without too much incident. This case may have been notorious at the time because the whole thing was caught by a local news crew, and there is footage of that. It's not too upsetting, like, compared to some of these things that have been caught on live TV. There is someone in between you and the incident, so you don't necessarily see anything too horrifying, but it's pretty horrifying on its own. So this is the story of that case. We'll hear later what happened to Plachet, but this show is interesting. I mean, well, why don't you talk about the show in terms of, did you think it was as bad as you were maybe expecting it to be, given the luridity of the subject? Because I was kind of weirdly impressed by the reenactments. Like, they were a lot, but
yeah,
they're better than usual. And I think all those kids are actually related to the actor playing their mom.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They do all really look alike. I'm just guessing. Yeah. I didn't check.
Well, I found when I was... originally, like, kind of turned on to this case. That sounds crazy, but I found this YouTube clip and it was really interesting. It was very short, and it had, you know, Jody was in it and his brother and whatnot, his whole family. And this one was basically just like that, but expanded. Yeah, I thought it was really good. I was surprised. I'd never seen an episode of the show before. You know, I discovered the case before the show. So, yeah, I liked it. I thought it was much better done than a lot of the investigation discovery stuff.
Yeah, I agree. And it does have, you can sometimes tell what quality you're dealing with based on the people they get for the talking head interviews. And Real Crime Profile's Jim Clemente, who you may also remember from the JonBenet case show on CBS last year, is one of the talking heads and is his usual sugar-free self. But in clip 7, we're going to hear a little bit about what sent Plachet into the fatal tailspin.
But the happy reunion is short-lived when a detective from the sheriff's office stops by 12 days later.
So, what's going on?
It shouldn't be coming from me, but Jody's test results came back.
And
they're positive.
What does that mean?
That Jody was raped.
That can't be. He told us that nothing happened. He wouldn't lie to us about something like that.
Are you scared?
He said he was fine. I don't understand.
Dare he do that?
I mean,
oh God.
Okay, this reenactment clip has it all. There's like crazy right. music at the beginning. Yeah. There's the nutty overacting. There's the nobody talks like this. Like,
right.
There isn't like a rape test. Like, find a different way to put that.
Right. Came back positive.
The test came back for rape. That's not how right. the world works, but okay.
I do have to say the accents are spot on. The accents are very good.
Okay. Good to know.
As far as that.
These people were in Baton Rouge, right?
Yes. Yes.
Baton Rouge.
And actually, so here's how I found out about it. A friend of mine has an older brother who went to school with Jody Plachet, which is real crazy.
Yeah. That is sort of crazy. And then it's interesting the way they set up Jody's involvement in the show, because in the beginning, you have the other two sons talking about their dad and how he was a family guy and he was like struggling with alcohol and it caused problems in the marriage. And I have to say, I feel like the show probably could have just been half an hour because there was really, really a lot of lead up. Like, do we need the reenactment with the
right,
with the spouse sort of disapproving of that one more beer? Like, we all are grown ups.
Oh, right. And when he went to the LSU game at the bar.
Yeah.
And she's mad.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We don't need that.
I will say I tried to get a screen grab of this, but I couldn't manage it. But that actor's like drunk burp, and he's like, "Ooh, that he was good. He's a pro. That guy took a lot of fake cream soda beer to get
gross.
That effect." Yeah, but it was just like I don't think we really need all of this. But I thought it was very effective that it's only when, like, I think it's only when Doucette has invited Jody to go on an errand with him. And then I guess the errand was in Los Angeles, whatever.
California. Right.
Then Jody is participating. And I just sort of assumed we weren't going to see adult Jody because he's like, nah, like this was a really weird thing. And I don't want this to be my whole life. But he seems pretty square. I mean, what can you tell from like 8 minutes of talking head footage? But he says, like, once he finally admitted to his parents that Doucette had been molesting him, then he felt really free.
Right. Yeah. He was like, it felt so good. I went and rode my bike and like felt the wind in my hair or something like that.
Yeah, and didn't have to think about this because I think Doucette, as many pedophiles do, like threatened to hurt him or his family if he said anything because he's a monster.
So, I feel like adult Jody has had a lot of therapy. You know, he seemed, you can't really tell, but he seems super well adjusted. And I think he does like motivational speaking or he works on behalf of children who have been molested.
That's awesome.
So
good for you, Jody.
Good
also
work.
The name Jody is just cool.
Right.
I always wanted to be named Jody when I was a kid. Jody or Jamie, they just seem like such cool tough names.
Oh my gosh.
So anyway, he was set free by telling the truth.
Yes,
but
but Gary is devastated to learn the extent of the molestation.
Here's a father who thought he was helping out his son by encouraging a relationship with Jeff, only to find out that Jeff had been basically raping his son for a year.
Ugh. Raping his son for a year.
Don't sugarcoat it, Jim Clemente. Just come right out and say whatever you feel. I will also say when it comes to accents, there's just something about Jim Clemente. I know I outweigh him by about 50 pounds, but I have kind of a crush on Jim Clemente.
Yeah, well.
Is that weird?
No, I like it.
Okay.
Feels good to me.
Okay. Well, that's what we're about here.
Right.
It's a safe space for inappropriate true crime crushes. Here on The Blotter Presents.
Yeah, I had several.
Do you have anything you would like to share right now?
I really enjoyed Sebastian Burns' dad. He had some sort of weird, like, Canadian British accent. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
He was very charming. I don't know. There was something about him. He had this weird haircut with like no sideburns, but it was still, I was like, I can feel you, Sebastian's dad. You're good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that.
That's my sad confession.
All right. Well, I support you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's wrap this up. Jody now has been molested by a guy who, P.S., looks exactly like Adam Kaufman, the actor. And that guy, like, the casting in this was actually pretty good. Like, they show pictures of the real people, and it's pretty close.
Yeah, it is.
He's been molested by this karate felon for a year. He's been kidnapped. He's been brought back. His father is now in custody because he shot Doucette in the head at the airport, as I guess you do, because it all turned out pretty well, all things considered, for Gary. Let's hear our last clip.
After months of negotiations, Gary pleads no contest to manslaughter. He's sentenced to 7 years suspended, 5 years probation, and 300 hours of community service. He spends no time in prison.
There was no doubt in my heart, no doubt in my professional capacity, that we would not have had anything but a hung jury because of people's sentiments. And as a result of that, to me, a very fair resolution was to allow a plea to manslaughter.
Yeah, I mean, ain't a court in the land, et cetera. Like, I always make that joke, but this time it's true. I just think, okay, like, you could probably get him on, like, misdemeanor discharging a firearm in an airport, but nobody else is going to convict him on anything that has him do time, even though he had a total meltdown. And, like, okay, that's not how we deal with things, but what parent or even non-parents would blame him?
Right, yeah. None. I mean, sometimes vigilante justice, I guess, works out, you know? That was, it almost seemed like a Law and Order episode, you know, like,
yeah,
this kind of stuff you don't really think happens. And then, you know, I guess now we needed a happy ending, I guess, happy as in scare quotes. But yeah, this case is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, and I can see, prosecutors being like, all right, does it actually help the kid to lock his father up? Probably not.
Right.
Did I see correctly that the mom and dad got back together after?
I can't remember. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I was like distracted by something, and it seemed like they were at least very friendly, and they were like playing with a puppy together.
Yeah, I think they continued to do like what they had done before, which was have like family dinners and, you know, kind of a family unit type thing, even if they weren't together.
Well, I hope that everything turned out okay for the family. Gary himself passed away of multiple strokes a couple of years ago. I would watch Unraveled again. This was, I mean, it's not like great. It's still only like a B minus.
It's,
but it does a lot of things better than usual, and it looks expensive too.
Right. Yeah. And it's short, you know, it's 40 minutes. So, I would watch it again too.
Sure. I mean, it probably should have been like 22 minutes, but you know what? It was a perfectly pleasant 42, minutes.
Right.
Speaking of perfectly pleasant 42 minutes, I think that our time is about up on this episode, but before we close, Annabeth, where might listeners find you if they would like to?
You can find me on Twitter at abchao, A-B-C-H-A-O, and on, I guess, Instagram. I don't really use that anymore, but you can find me there, too.
Are the youngs not using Instagram anymore? I'm never sure.
I'm an old. I don't know. I think the youngs are using Snapchat.
Oh, okay. Snapchat? Chat mom.
Snapchat.
I know. Duly noted. All right, folks. Thanks for listening to The Blotter Presents. Next time, Mark Blankenship is back to talk about two takes on the murder of Sam Cooke. Ain't that good news? And Stephanie Early Green, notorious hater of the disappearance of Maura Murray, will be back to talk about the brand new TV version of Maura Murray's story. Will it have the same ending? Will she feel the same about it? Who's to say? Shout back at us on Twitter at Blotter Presents and on Facebook at Blotter Presents. You can visit us on the forums at previously.tv/forums. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to ask for cases to be covered on our tip line. That's in the forums. I just told you the URL. We'll talk to you next time on The Blotter Presents.
Been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.